for all you big government Wall Street types.
Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. If a single one of them are in cahoots, he's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia too. He's a white man in a business suit.
This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Why do so many workers cross class lines to vote for Republican candidates whom they should view as their class enemies? It must be recognized that some voters are already voting their self-interest. At least 70% of people of color, for example, voted against the president. 89% of African Americans did so, and union households voted overwhelmingly for Bush's removal. So which voters were ignoring their class interests? The problem is, by and large, white folks in the anxious middle class, whose incomes range between $30,000 and $50,000 a year. It's these folks who seem to ignore their class interests and vote Republican. But why? What's the matter with white folks? Let's listen to Tim Wise, director of the Association for White Anti-Racist Education.
In the wake of the presidential election in 2004, there was this very large discussion, and it's still going on, among liberals now. And this is a discussion which basically was touched off by Thomas Frank's best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? What that book essentially was asking was why it was that working-class folks, middle Americans, in Frank's terms, Kansans, but Kansans were to some extent a metaphor for middle American working-class folks generally, why was it that they were voting against their economic interest, voting for candidates like George W. Bush, voting for a party whose, you know, economic policies, tax policies, monetary policies are principally policies that benefit the wealthy, and that that's certainly not the class in which most of these working-class middle Americans find themselves. In other words, why was this group essentially betraying its class interest? And, of course, what Thomas Frank essentially argued was that the right had mastered the politics of manipulation using social policies, abortion, gay rights, etc., to essentially distract these working-class middle Americans from their real interest. And then he criticized the Democrats, which is certainly fair to do, for not appealing to the class interest of these folks and therefore allowing them to be deluded and tricked by the social policy rhetoric of the right. Now, it was an interesting book, and its prescription for the Democrats to talk openly about class and appeal to class interest is certainly a better prescription than what you'll hear from people in the Democratic Leadership Council who would like the Democratic Party to ignore class altogether. But what's interesting about Frank's argument is that it's really very typical for a white liberal. Essentially, first of all, he's misdiagnosing the problem. The reality is that it's unfair to say and inaccurate to say that working class people don't realize their class interest or that they are being diluted or taken away from their class interest. Because after all, which working class people are we talking about? Black working class people aren't missing it. Latino working class people aren't missing it. Asian Pacific American working class people aren't missing it. If you look at the polls, it's really very clear. Folks of color, even using the most favorable estimates for President Bush, voted at least 70-30 against the president. Black folks did so by an 89-11 margin. It was essentially white folks, white working class and so-called middle class folks, who either split right down the middle in the case of the real hardcore working class, or in the case of the lower middle class, whose economic interests are clearly more like the working class than they are like the wealthy, who nonetheless were casting their lot with the president. So the problem really wasn't working class people as working class people or middle Americans, whatever the hell that means. The problem was white people, especially white folks in the anxious middle class, so-called, people whose incomes are vulnerable, though not poverty level, so somewhere between, let's say, $30,000 and $50,000, which, depending on where you live, is sort of anxious middle class, lower middle class. That's not the poor. That's not even the working poor. That's just sort of the hardcore working or lower middle class. They're certainly closer to the working class than the wealthy, and yet they continue to be voting primarily Republican. But we didn't talk about that. This white problem in terms of white voting behavior has been completely off the radar. It was off Frank's radar. It's been off the American Prospect and the nation's radar by and large. But this racial electoral divide is huge. It's much bigger, in fact, than any of the other divides that we hear about. So if you talk about the gender gap, which we always talk about every year, well, there is a gender gap in voting. But in this election, 2004, a presidential election, that gap was only 7 points. The gap between people earning $30,000 to $50,000 and those earning $100,000 to $150,000, a pretty big difference economically, that was only an 8-point gap. Meanwhile, the racial gap in voting between whites and people of color was 28 points. That's even bigger than the 21-point gap that divided those at the bottom of the income scale between $15,000 and $30,000 a year and those with incomes above $200,000 a year. That gap was only 21 points between whites and people of color. It was 28. Between whites and blacks, as a specific group within the group of color, the white-black divide was 47 points. That's actually a modern record because Bush increased his vote among white voters by 4 points, got 58% of all white votes cast, 62% of white men, 55% of white women. It's important to understand this. In other words, for all we talk about the gender gap or the class gap, the racial gap's much bigger. The racial gap was actually really huge, and this is important, among evangelical Christians. And that's especially important because you kept hearing all this stuff about, oh, well, evangelicals are responsible for Bush's victory. But in fact, only white evangelicals were responsible for Bush's victory. Black evangelicals, a very large group, voted against Bush by margins of at least 4-1, despite the fact that many of them perhaps agree with the right on certain issues like abortion, gay rights, prayer in schools, etc. But it was white evangelicals and born-again Christians, so-called, who voted 78-21 for Bush, which is a huge increase from the 62% average that the Republican candidate has gotten from white evangelicals in the two previous elections. So it was really white evangelicals that did it. Why don't we talk about that? In other words, the problem isn't what's the matter with Kansas. The problem isn't what's the matter with working class people. What's the matter with evangelical Christians? The problem is what's the matter with whites in all of these groups. In fact, this racial divide was much bigger than the so-called red state, blue state divide, which is, you know, pretty much all we heard about after the election. So it hasn't been very much mentioned, but whites voted mostly for Bush, or at least split 50-50, even in the blue states like New York, California, Maryland, Illinois, states that I think most people think of as inveterately blue, and yet whites in those states either voted mostly for Bush or split down the middle 50-50. Meanwhile, in the red states, people of color voted overwhelmingly against the president. So once again, even what we see as a geographic divide actually is more racial than anything else. So this brings up the question, if the interracial voting differences are bigger than the differences based on geography, gender, income, education, age, occupation, religion, any other factor, the question then is why? Why is it that white people are voting so differently from people of color? Why do white evangelicals vote so differently from evangelicals of color? Why do white working class and lower middle class whites often vote against their class interests while working class and lower income people of color don't? And there's another element to this, too, I want to point out. There's another great book that came out, actually, I think, better than Frank's book, that came out a year or so ago. It's called The Wimp Factor by Stephen Ducott. And it's an examination of the motivations behind male voting behavior. And what Ducott suggests, among other things, is that anxious masculinity, as he calls it, prompts men to seek a reassertion of their domination through a macho politics of control and sort of semi-authoritarian policies. But what he overlooks, too, in what is otherwise a really quite good book, is how race and especially whiteness actually fills out his theory, because men of color, for example, although they're subjected to the same patriarchal messages, the same conditioning as white men, usually do not go out and vote for right-wing candidates the way that white men do. So why? Why do white men vote differently from men of color? In other words, I guess flipping Thomas Frank's question a little bit, the issue to me here is not what's the matter with Kansas, but what's the matter with white people. And I want to suggest four reasons why white people vote so differently from people of color who are otherwise like them in terms of class, in terms of gender, in terms of religion. Because this is critical for those of us who are on the left, who are trying to figure out ways to get white folks to appeal to their class interests, to build a class-based coalition for social justice, which I think is a goal that most of us have. And I would suggest the reason that it is so difficult is this unspoken white problem. The first problem with whiteness and the way that it affects working class-based coalitions, left politics, in a negative way, and makes it harder to organize on the basis of class and build a movement for social justice, that most whites have the luxury of believing in the system of meritocracy. If you look at the history of class-based politics, it's always been more difficult in the United States to gain traction with class-based politics, because unlike the European nations where Marxism first gained some traction, here in this country, the whole concept of merit-based advancement has really been the fundamental building block of the nation's political ethos. The myth of individual merit, the myth of mobility, has been really central to the construction of our political soul as a nation. And that myth of meritocracy is especially alluring to white people because our experiences with upward mobility, since we're the favored or the dominant racial group, our experiences with that have been just good enough to allow our faith in that concept of merit-based advancement to be maintained over time. So if you're really poor and white, you might know better. You know, if you're really poor and white, in fact, you do know better, and the polls show that you tend to vote against ruling class interests. So in fact, you know, the real hardcore working class and poor white folks did vote against the president. They probably understood their class interests were not in voting for someone like that. But if you look at people who have incomes around the midpoint, around the median, though they're very vulnerable, they're certainly one or two paychecks away from destitution, perhaps a layoff away from real trouble, they are likely to be doing just well enough to believe that a little harder work, a little more job training, they can climb to that next level on the class ladder. So those are the kind of people who are going to be very skeptical of class-based appeals for their vote. In fact, they may feel no animosity for people above them, and in fact, they may expect that one day they're going to join them in the ranks of the affluent, so they don't want to bash the boss because they honestly believe they might be the boss. And even though they don't have any real reason to expect that, they see just enough experience with upward mobility to think it's possible. So that is problem number one. It doesn't mean that class-based appeals can't work, but it means that the white problem, if problem of just having enough privilege to see light at the end of the tunnel, makes it harder to appeal on the basis of class. The second problem that is part of this white problem as it plays out in our politics today is that, contrary to what most of us on the left, I think, have long believed, self-interest is not just an economic or class concept. And I think we've made the mistake of thinking that it is, this idea that if we just appeal to people's self-interest, their class interest, that that would be enough. But that's only true if they define self-interest only in economic terms. But if you look at the history of this country, whites in particular have long been willing to overlook our class interest for the sake of that racial privilege, whether it was at the time of the end of indentured servitude, the Civil War, the Union movement, we've been willing to do that. So in other words, something is going on. In spite of the obvious class interest that would be furthered for most white people by greater levels of integration and racial equity and unity, it's nonetheless been resisted. So to some extent, white privilege, white supremacy, has offered white an alternative identity. And what that means is an alternative identity besides our class status, around which we can rally. There's a term that Cheryl Harris, who's a brilliant law professor at UCLA, has termed, where she says whiteness is a form of property, and it's every bit as valuable to those who have it as the material goods they might receive by voting for more progressive candidates. So contrary to Marx, who would say this was false consciousness, it's not really false, it's alternative consciousness. It's the prioritizing of non-economic interest by people who've been offered alternative benefits in a system of racial inequity. So if you have white people, even those who are very vulnerable economically, if they come to view progressive government policy or progressive candidates as a threat to their hegemonic control of the society, whether it's through immigration, affirmative action, welfare, social service programs, or even a foreign policy that isn't sufficiently belligerent to non-white terrorists, it ought not surprise us then that those persons might ignore their class interest and vote instead for what they view as their other interest, including those that are essentially conceived in racial terms. But here's an important point. It's not only race that gives an alternative identity to which whites can cleave, so too with gender, religion, sexual orientation. So, for example, if you're a heterosexual male evangelical but you're black, you'd have a pretty hard time ignoring your economic interest because they're just so clearly endangered by right-wing politics of the ruling class. And so even if you share the gender, the religious, the sexual anxieties of white heterosexual male evangelicals, the reality is even if you share all the same politics and anxieties about sexuality and all that as white men, the fact of the matter is that whites enjoy enough mobility in most cases to allow us to ignore class and instead emphasize our status as men or emphasize our status as straight Christians or whatever. But for people of color, it's very different. While black men might, in that situation, are going to logically view their greatest challenge to their patriarchal manhood, even if they are horribly patriarchal and horribly sexist and horribly homophobic and heterosexist, they're still likely to view the biggest threats to their manhood as systemic, the inability, thanks to a racialized class system, to provide for their families, for example. And so they're going to vote in more progressive ways, even if they share a lot of the reactionary views on sexuality. Whose ability to serve as providers tends to be more secure, you know, have the luxury of viewing the biggest threats to our manhood in what I would call decidedly gonadal terms, you know, threats from feminists, threats from homosexuals, et cetera. So appeals to homophobia, appeals to anxious masculinity, as Ducott puts it in his book, The Wimp Factor, are going to be more likely to work with whites than people of color, and they can often trump class concerns, not because of false consciousness in Marxist terms, but through the capacity of privilege to create alternative interests and alternative forms of property. Same thing with religion. White evangelical Christianity has always been fundamentally different from that practice by people of color. And that difference is the difference between the faith of the conqueror and that of the conquered. So if you look at black Christianity, it has long been a theology of liberation, a theology of redemption, of deliverance. The Christianity of white America has almost always been, in its fundamentalist conception, a theology of dominion. So that when that hegemonic Christianity is challenged in any way, even by pluralism, to say nothing of any real challenge, those who aren't accustomed to having their privileged status of their particular religion questioned, or simply having to coexist with others who have different views, logically engage in backlash. So if you look at evangelicals of color, for example, they can conceive, and they do conceive, of so-called moral issues as including poverty, unemployment, racism, wars abroad that are unjust. But white evangelicals literally cannot, in most cases, think of morality that way, because for white evangelicals to think of morality as including poverty, unemployment, racism, and unjust war would require those whites to interrogate their own role in immorality, their own privileges, the degree to which those privileges come at the expense of others. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that whether the issues in an election are explicitly racial, or whether they merely play to the gender, the sexual, the racial, and religious anxieties of whites, whose privileges allow us to define our identities in ways that are not as workers, but as something else, you know, whites, men, heterosexuals, etc. As long as that's possible, the effect is the same. Whites are going to remain far more resistant to class-based appeals, populist appeals for votes, because our electoral behavior is based less on values in the abstract, or moral values specifically, and more on the value that whites have come to place upon maintaining our relative status as members of privileged groups. So that's a significant white person or white people problem. The third reason why it's hard to deal with whiteness in the political system, or the problem that whiteness creates for us, is that there's a certain cynicism about the prospects for change, and that makes it very hard to appeal to whites on the basis of class and get them away from their white thinking. To some extent, there's a real cynicism, a real skepticism about the ability to change the system. And I realize that's the opposite of what I said before, which was this, you know, sort of unbridled faith in the system, which leads people to expect their hard work to pay off. But the irony is that both optimism and the pessimism can exist side by side, if not in the same individual, certainly in the larger body politic. So if the class system, for example, is this powerful monolith in which the wealthy pretty much kick the rest of our asses, we ought not be surprised when some people who recognize that come to despair of their ability to change that system, and therefore do what? They decide to gravitate to other forms of political mobilization than those offered by class consciousness. And there's really a sort of a psychological logic to it, right? That is, the more convinced you are that you're getting your ass kicked by the rich, the more likely that you're going to look for ways to be a winner other than class rebellion, because that just seems so hard. So while I think those of us on the left have long assumed that working class folks would respond to rising class consciousness with rebellion, or at least by pushing for reform, in fact, there's another option we don't talk about, which is that folks can become so defeatist about the prospects for change that they seek refuge elsewhere. And that refuge could be provided for some by the politics of race and whiteness, the politics of gender and male domination, the politics of religion and Christian supremacy, or the politics of sexual orientation and straight supremacy. And so by sort of clinging to racial, religious, gender, and sexual identities, people like that can identify with this inspiring vision of domination. After all, despite feeling under siege, you know, by gays, by women, by minorities, by secular humanists and all that, despite identifying as being sort of attacked by them, if you identify your interest as straight people, as men, as Christians, etc., as white folks, that does seem to be more empowering to a lot of people than identifying as a worker. Such a person can remember a time when straight white Christian men were not only dominant, which they still are, but when they exercised a kind of control that was really unquestioned. But they cannot envision a time in this country when workers like them were running the show, because workers haven't been running the show. So even if they find economic populism appealing intellectually, they might become cynical about the prospects for change on that level. And so when they get frustrated, they turn to those arenas of daily life where they're likely to be more successful, where their strength is palpable, where their privileges are still very much intact. And in keeping with that, you know, we have this cultural attachment to winners in this society, which makes class-based politics very hard, so that people seek to identify with the winners, whether it's a sports team or billionaires like Donald Trump with his TV show or Bill Gates or whatever. So if you ask workers to identify their interests as workers and act upon those interests, that's like asking them to identify, by definition, with the losers in the class game. And there's absolutely nothing in this culture less appealing than to be labeled a loser. So if you're white, if you're Christian, if you're male, if you're heterosexual, you can identify your interest in those terms. Those are terms where you're still a winner. As a worker, you're a loser in the class game, but as a Christian, you're a winner in the religious hegemony game. As a white person, you're a racial winner. As a heterosexual, you're the winner there. You know, as a man, you're the one who's dominant. So that allows you to nurture a sense of power, a sense of superiority, and I think, unfortunately, that makes it very hard for class-based appeals. People of color really can't ignore their marginal economic status or their vulnerability. And even poor whites can. But if you're in the middle class or the lower working class, where your economic status is precarious but not desperate, you have the luxury of identifying with those other identities, and that takes you away from your actual interests, getting us back once again to this issue of the so-called white problem. In closing, the question is, what do we do with all of this? If whites are largely out of touch with the workings of their own country, with the workings of the world, and with their own interest, by and large, what do we do? The answer is, I don't have the answer to that, but I do think there are at least some lessons that we can learn from this to help us push a progressive and left politics forward. First of all, we have to come to realize that we have a white problem, and we have to be willing to call it that, and recognize that the problem is directly related to white privilege. To the extent that whites have advantages over people of color, it becomes likely that many whites will seek to maximize their relative advantage over others rather than thinking of their self-interest in class terms. So what we're going to have to do as a left is confront white privilege directly. We'll have to demonstrate the harm that racial inequality does to those without the privilege and to the larger societies. In other words, we can't run away from race and racism as an issue. We can't leapfrog the issues of race in the name of class solidarity, which sometimes white leftists like to do, because it is precisely race and racism that is making class solidarity less likely and has always done so. So we have to confront the beast head on. Next, we have to point out, and this is especially for white leftists, the destructive downside to a system of inequality, a system of privilege. We have to articulate and we have to organize around an analysis that focuses on the ways that those inequalities, those hostilities, make our communities less sustainable. They increase the likelihood of crime, terrorism, economic problems. They contribute to the anxieties that so many Americans feel. Trying to maintain your edge over others, whether it's racial, religious, gender, or national, takes an enormous amount of energy, feeds an almost paranoid devotion to getting others before they get you, which leads to some horribly dysfunctional and destructive policies. So if you're opposed to the war in Iraq, if you're opposed to the ecological destruction of the planet, which is proceeding at warp speed right now, all of it the result of a mentality of entitlement that says we have the right to use the resources however we see fit, all of that going back in some way to this mentality of domination and privilege, then you can begin to see the consequences of the road that we're on. And I think if we make that clear and if we link up those issues of ecological catastrophe, war and imperialism and empire to this larger mentality of white hegemony and white entitlement, we can begin to link the issues in a way that will make it clear to those in the dominant group what we ourselves have to lose by continuing on this path. Third, I think we have to develop a narrative of fairness that directly creates shame around racism, sexism, heterosexual supremacy, and Christian supremacy. You know, most white people who cling to those forms of domination haven't really been challenged to think about their views. They haven't really been challenged to think about what their positions mean for others. I think most people are probably decent. I think most people are rational. And we also should assume that they can be reached by appeals to fairness, especially if those appeals are combined with self-interest appeals that I've already talked about. But I think we have to do that. And of course, most whites may not respond to those appeals. People who receive privilege and advantage from the system are obviously loath to respond to changing it. But I think we could certainly build enough of a cadre of allies within the white working class and within white communities more largely to combine those individuals with folks of color who really are always going to need to be the leaders of the anti-racist struggle, to create the breathing room that we'll need to challenge both major parties and the larger political economic system. So we have to lead with a message of truth, a message of fairness, and a message of self-interest all combined in one, to try and create as large a cadre of allies as possible. And finally, I think we really have to bring to bear a vision of possible social change, of possible economic transformation. You know, it isn't enough for us to argue that the tax cuts that are being pushed by Republicans are only for the rich, or to claim that the health care plan of Democrats is, you know, marginally better than the one being offered by Republicans, unless voters are given a reason to believe that real transformative change is possible. It's going to make sense for them to ignore their class interest. It's going to make sense for them to define their perceived interest in those areas where they feel a greater level of efficacy, a greater level of control. So the left is really going to have to sit down and revisit and extend our analysis about what this nation and what this world's economy, what the political system should look like, how the system to which we've grown accustomed might change, how the work in this country might be organized differently, how communities might be reconceptualized, how education might be reconceptualized to allow working people to exercise greater power and control over their lives. And I don't expect a Democratic Party to do this, and I don't have the answers as to what that would look like, but that is at least part of the conversation we've got to have. We've got to begin to focus on those future visions, trading in, if you will, what we're against in favor of trying to conceptualize the world that we're for. What we must understand is that white folks are a political breed unto ourselves, but unless we understand what makes white folks tick under a system of whiteness and white domination, we're not likely to reverse the rising tide of reactionary sentiment in this country among so many otherwise decent and nice and helpful and wonderful white folks who probably deep down understand or would be willing to understand the truth but have been led astray for so long. So ultimately, I guess, in conclusion, we have a white problem, and we have to acknowledge the white problem, not only in terms of what it means for persons who do not have membership in the club, but even for those who do have membership in the club, because in the long run, it's dysfunctional, it's pathological, and it's really quite destructive for us all. Thank you.
Well, I got sued by a lawyer. He was after my loot. He was a white man in a business suit. I got fired by my boss because I wouldn't lick his boots. He was a white man in a business suit.
You've been listening to Tim Wise on What's the Matter with White Folks.
White man in a business suit. I got rejected for a loan at the financial institute by a white man in a business suit. I tried talking to my congressman. He didn't give a hoot. He was a white man in a business suit.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.
Well, there's a whole lot of things I'd rather do than be a white man in a business suit. I'd rather be ragged with holes in my shoes than be a white man in a business suit.